We are about to delve into the world of behaviors. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org. This is Jack, and today I'm here with Kathy and Shayna from Mental Mages Podcast. We are going to overview some of the behaviors that we see in foster care from children who have experienced trauma. Thank you, ladies, so much for coming to chat with me today.
Thank you for having us.
I have a very serious question to ask both of you. I need to know what both of your favorite beverages are at Starbucks.
I really like the cinnamon dolce anything, iced coffee, hot, or the frappuccino.
I have never had somebody say that before, and I don't think I've tried it. So I'm going to put that on the list.
It's so good.
I like the iced chai latte, which my daughter says tastes like Michael's, the craft store.
I can see that.
Not only is the chai my favorite drink and my co-host's favorite drink, but it's also probably the most popular answer when Ooh. We ask our guests that. I'm curious if you've tried it with the lavender cold foam that came out.
No, I had it with the pumpkin when that was seasonal, but I have not had the lavender cold foam. So
Kat had mentioned to me that somebody at the Starbucks she was at was drinking a chai with lavender foam, and I got kind of excited. The first time I tried it, I loved it. It was like the best drink ever. The second time I had it, I was like iffy on it.
It sounds like it could be iffy, but I'd be willing to give it a go.
Just look at me being the outlier all the time.
Always. It's great.
Always.
I appreciate you being the outlier because now I have something new to try.
It's so good. And if you like chai, because that has cinnamon stuff too, like you'll probably like cinnamon dolce.
Yeah.
So both of you are therapists. Can you tell me a little bit about how each of you kind of came to that?
So I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I have been a social worker for over 25 years now. When I originally went to college, I wanted to be a chemist, which is very different than where I ended up. And I found out probably the first year that that wasn't what I was really in love with. I wanted to help people. So I remember just reading through every single major that they had, and I got to social work all the way at the S's. And it was like, this is it. This is what I want to do with my life. And I also wanted to work with kids. So when it came time to do my first internship, I got an internship at a group home where there were 60 kids in foster care. That's what I did. And I worked primarily with, they had a teen mom program for the girls were in foster care. And then when they had their babies, then the babies would be in the foster care system too. And this placement would allow them to live together and hopefully teach them skills. So when they aged out of the system or whatever was happening with them, that they would have consistency with their own children. Mm-hmm. I went back for my master's and did my internship at a inpatient facility. So they had a crisis unit, a women's unit, and a dual diagnosis with substance use, but they were all adults. Now, inpatient's a whole different thing with adults. They were very much in crisis, very limited progress that you see a lot of people that are very, very hopeless. And one of the things that I found in that work was, I'm making up a percentage, but close to 99% of all of the adults that I interviewed there had childhood trauma that had never been addressed. So once I got my master's degree, I said, I'm going to go back and work with kids. And I actually went back to that first group home that I did my internship, and I worked there for a few years. So I worked at the group home Then I worked in therapeutic foster care. I did that for a while. Then I wrote CBHAs for several years, and also some adoption home studies, adoption child studies. And that was with the same agency where I work now. And then we started doing outpatient therapy. And that's pretty much what we do. I've been there at this agency for 18 years now. We still do CBHAs. I still review CBHAs that other people are writing. We do, because we are a Medicaid provider, we do have a lot of kids that come through that are in the system or have been, or parents that are have had their children removed and are going through mental health treatment. So I'm still working peripherally with the system. And I'm also currently a gal pal.
Is that like a gal volunteer, or is that something different? I've not heard gal pal before.
So it is, it's something, because we know for the GALs that they have to go through their trainings and backgrounds. And then we know, because of confidentiality, that they can't really talk about the cases with anyone other than their other gals or supervisors, but everyone is allowed to pick a person, a friend or family member that is a support person that goes through a much shorter training and goes through a process of background checks and all that stuff, that I'm essentially a support person actually for two different gals that we work with.
Can you tell me a little bit, Shayna, about your experience becoming a therapist and what your experience is with the foster care system?
I'm also a licensed clinical social worker. I wanted to be a speech pathologist. I wanted to help people. Then I figured out you need a lot of science, and I didn't want to do it. So I was looking at the college catalog, similar thing, and reading about the requirements to speech pathology and being upset about it. And right below speech pathology was social work. That's the degree that was right below it. And so then I was like, and I clicked on that. And honestly, it's funny that Kathy said that, but it, as I'm reading it, it was almost like the same thing. It was like everything clicked, like, no, this is exactly what I want to do. I actually even remember telling like my aunt, who's also a therapist, she was like, why would you want to do social work? I was like, ouch.
It really has to be something that your heart is in. Because it's not something you're going to go into and you're like, I'm going to make it rich. It's hard. Yeah. It's emotionally taxing. It doesn't create a lot of millionaires. So
exactly.
For someone to put all the work into this, it's also a lot of schooling.
It is. So it's, you know, you need your bachelor's degree. And then if you do want to be a therapist, you need to go to, you know, graduate school. So it's 4 or 5 years
and
of
then you,
school. And then you do continuing education every year to maintain your license.
1,500 hours of supervision after grad school to become licensed.
Even to graduate, you need 900 hours of internship. I interned in my bachelor's degree, interned at a shelter for mothers, either pregnant mother, you know, pregnant women or mothers with young children. I did case management. I realized that was not for me and went to grad school and interned at the agency that I work with now with Kathy. And so I specialize in working with children and teens. I do work with some adults, but my heart is definitely with kiddos with trauma. And then I also run groups, which is like my true passion. I love group therapy. And so my connection with the foster care system is definitely a lot, kind of what Kathy said, a lot of our population has some, a lot of them have some kind of, whether they were placed in like kinship care or a lot of the children that we see aren't necessarily being raised by their biological parents. And so I do have a lot of clients that have been adopted in care. And then I ran groups at a group home for a couple of years. And I am a foster slash almost adoptive parent myself within the last year and a half.
That really throws you pretty neck deep into it.
Oh, yeah.
They live in your home.
Oh, yeah, for sure. When my parent, you know, the parents that I work with are talking about behaviors now, I just think, oh, yes, I do know that behavior.
I am really excited to chat with you guys today. We had done an episode last season about behaviors. It actually was just like a really quick episode that we threw together because it was a conversation we were having and we're like, hey, let's go out and record this. And it turned out to be like our most listened to episode last.
Wow.
So we really wanted to talk more about it this year because I think it's something that a lot of us really struggle the most with, having a different situation than you've had maybe in the past, and learning how to handle that, because every kid's different, every situation's different, and even similar behaviors are all different. The more that we can learn about them, and the more that we can share that with our listeners, I feel like we can all, first of all, just understand that, you know, we don't have to always know everything right off the bat, and to assume that anybody, regardless of your experience, like regardless of how many kids I've had, when I have a new kid come in, I have to expect the unexpected and not assume mm-hmm. that I'm going to know how to be the best parent that I can for that child when they're in my house. So these are just good things for all of us to learn, whether we're new foster parents or been around a little bit longer. I'm really excited for you guys to be here to kick off this series with me, and to hear both your clinical and personal perspectives on these behaviors. Before we start, I wanted to be very clear about our feelings on behaviors. We have to understand that behaviors are a symptom of the trauma. When we're trying to, quote, fix our kids' behaviors, what we really want to do is to help them heal from the trauma that's causing the behaviors. Yes. Because if you're just trying to like train a kid to not do something, it's just going to come out in a different way. And if we really want to help them, then we should want to help them with the trauma, not necessarily stopping the behaviors. Those annoying behaviors are how that child has learned to cope and to handle the world around them. Even though this series is all about behaviors, it's really just about the trauma and how it plays out on the kids and how we can help them. So yeah. If you guys could share a little bit about behaviors.
A few things. Everybody has behaviors.
Yes.
No one is, you know, regulated or compliant 100% of the time. And we're talking about kids, and mm-hmm. children don't have quote unquote perfect or expected behaviors 100% of the time, even if they have zero trauma history. Mm-hmm. That is part of how their brain develops. That's how they learn. They mm-hmm. learn by testing boundaries. They're just slamming into those boundaries all the time. That's with no trauma. So then you add a layer of trauma onto it that impacts how a brain develops. It's just going to come out in all kinds of disruptive ways. One of the things that I do in the work that I do is I personally and professionally dislike labeling a child as oppositional defiant or with oppositional defiant disorder. And one of the things that I'll talk about with that is, oh, they might be absolutely very defiant and oppositional. And that is not easy behavior to live with. So I want to validate that. But there's always a reason. Mm-hmm. And so if we treat that reason, if we heal that reason or that trauma or address a mood disorder or ADHD or whatever's underlying that behavior, then the oppositional defiant behavior goes away.
And here's, you know, a fun statistic. 100% of children in foster care have trauma. 100%.
Even infants.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let me tell you.
Yeah. Having adopted several infants, right?
The very nature, obviously, of being adopted, that in itself is a trauma.
Yes,
being exactly. in foster care is a trauma. Yes. That initial removal, even, you know, every little bit of that, every step, like the removal from the hospital by a police officer, mm-hmm. like her mm-hmm. body does that. So yes. even at its most, like, least, quote, traumatic mm-hmm. possibility of an adoption, when the situation is like that, there is still trauma, and we deal with it on the regular. And I'm sure, especially when the teen years hit, it will create its own animal. But yeah, every child that is in foster care, every child that is adopted has at the very least had the trauma of being separated from their biological family.
And that's another thing about trauma is people rework that trauma, so to speak, from a psychological perspective at different developmental stages and different life stages. So yes, like you said, when she's an adolescent or mm-hmm. when this child's an adolescent, they will be reworking it when they move out of the house the first time, mm-hmm. when they find a partner, when they maybe have their own children. All of those are times that they rework that trauma in some way. Sometimes it doesn't end up being really intrusive to their life, but sometimes it can be. It doesn't go away, but it does absolutely become something that becomes a fabric of who the person is and something they manage.
One of the other things to kind of be aware of is that there is a stimulus or trigger that is creating these behaviors. A behavior is defined as the way in which an animal or person acts in response to a particular situation or stimulus. So sometimes as parents, we look at our kids and we're like, oh, like, why are they doing this? But to keep in mind, like, there's something behind what is happening, and whether that's like a physical or emotional trigger that is coming out in that moment, there's always a reason behind it. And it's our job as parents to try to investigate and figure out what that is and how we can help them with that.
It's about being curious and being open to that, and also recognizing that most of the time the kids don't even know what is triggering them. I know you'll have guests on that will explain more about, you know, the neuroscience behind all of that, and and how maybe triggers are formed at a very basic level. When traumatic events happen, your brain can't determine what part of that scenario is what is unsafe. So it's almost like it takes a snapshot of everything that's happening in that moment. So the sights, the smells, the sounds, the way things, you know, feel, all of those things become a part of what is coded as unsafe or potentially unsafe. So though that's how triggers start to develop, is because it is a part of that thing. And so an easiest way to think about it is everyone has a scent that you smell something, let's say Play-Doh. You can smell Play-Doh and you're instantly 10 years old again. It's a trigger. It's not a trauma trigger, but it's tied into that memory that for a brief moment puts you back into a place. For most people, the smell of Play-Doh brings up happy memories. So it doesn't make them dysregulated. It may make them smile to themselves or think about a time where they were happy and joyful and playing. But if you have something that a smell that reminds you of something that was not pleasant, you're going to be dysregulated. And dysregulation is what leads to behavior.
Something that I love to, like, when I have the trauma education talk with my clients is, you know, something fascinating happens to the brain where, like, literally our logical brain goes offline and it, like, almost like flips up. It's where, like, flip your lid came from. That's a scientific-based
term. Yeah, flipping your lid.
I didn't know that. That's neat.
And, you know, like where we store our feelings in the midbrain, it's not logical. Our feelings are not logical. It is not where we make our conscious choices. It is reactive. And so, and that is what we see.
Which is the reason why when someone is dysregulated, when their lid has flipped and you try to engage a consequence, or if you don't calm down right now, you're going to be grounded. But they don't care. Exactly. Yes. They're not in their logical brain. Right. So they literally can't care at that time because they're not functioning in their logical cause and effect brain. They're functioning from a dysregulated place, and they're functioning from a place of unsafe survival. And so those survival feelings or states, in general, they're separated into four different things, which people are aware of, and they call fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Fawn is one we talk about more recently. It's not as talked about in a lot of circles, but fight, flight, and freeze are ones that a lot of people are really aware of. Pretty much most of the time, especially with kids in foster care, kids with trauma histories, when they are having either external or internal dysregulation, they are functioning in one of these states.
Some of them are super obvious, like when you've got these teens and they get triggered in some way, 9 times out of 10, what do? They hop out a window and they run. They run. Like, I mean, that is that not the most common thing, especially the older kids in foster care, is they're runners. Like when you get a call about a teenage kid and they're asking if you'll take placement, the first thing they tell you is not a runner, I promise. Or this one's a runner, keep an eye on her. You know, or sometimes they just don't tell you. You find out when the window gets open and they book it. And what's interesting is I've seen the flight response. I've seen that happen in such a wide variety of things. I had one kid who tried to run away because my husband said, I love you, buddy. And he was like, no, you don't. No, you don't. Like, this is a kid who spent like his whole life in foster care. 5 or 6 failed adoptions. When somebody told him that, he just like balled up. It, like, don't be another person to tell me that and not mean it.
So I know what happens next. My brain knows what happens next. People have said this to me before.
Exactly. And he ended up getting Baker acted for the millionth time. I still love that kid. Like, that kid will always have my heart.
As we're talking about this, I just kind of put Baker Act as a possible way and actually a pretty frequent way that kids in foster care use to flee.
They need a break.
Know
exactly what to say.
Yeah.
You know, after that, I had other teens that would do similar things. And I just kind of learned that a lot of these behaviors are self-protective, and it's things that they learn how to do because they've had to be the one to protect themselves. Unfortunately, sometimes in foster homes, they don't feel safe. And sometimes that's for good reason, but they learn that if they say these things and they're in a foster home, they will get to get out of that foster home. They will get a break. They will get a vacation from school. They get to go hang out in a facility for 3 days. Is it fun being locked up? No. And honestly, it doesn't. I want to take a nap.
We all need a break. And the other thing is there's structure and predictability in that. And they're safe.
It's true.
So I imagine, like, you know, when you go to a bowling alley and you have a little kid with you and they put the bumpers up, that it's like that. That here's a lane, but you can bump up against as much as you want, and you're just going to bounce right off to safety. Like, you're never going to get in a situation where you can be hurt. And that is, honestly, it's part of healing. It's part of what happens, healing in relationships with caregivers, that they can be consistent with.
So running away, Baker acts, those are some of the ways that they express their flight.
Another one is the avoidance, just not showing up, ghosting. I know a big one that we see in therapy is if we have a client that really starts to maybe dig into trauma, you never hear from them again. They are running. I've worked with people where it's like they might actually have a healthy friendship for the first time, ghost them. It's so sad.
Little Jack is like the epitome of freeze. And that looks a lot like non-compliance. And like sometimes literally his body just freezes, or like the selective mutism. Like these are how he can, I guess, have some control over the world that might feel out of control to him. They also may have been like self-protection, not knowing what environment he was in previous, like maybe like speaking too much got him in trouble. I don't know.
Sometimes you might see it with a kid being unable to make a decision of what you might think would be a really simple decision.
Yeah.
Like, do you want the purple popsicle or the red popsicle? And it feels like this is the most dire thing. Like, that would be a freeze response to me. And you're laughing because you're like, yep, this is what happens in my life.
this kid is like one of the smartest humans I know. Also like one of the most athletic humans I know. But like, if you ask him a direct question that is like, do you want this or this, or like an open-ended question, he freezes. Like, he is brilliant, but he cannot answer a basic question. He cannot tell you what kind of popsicle he wants. He cannot tell you what he wants to eat. He was playing sports this week, and he grabbed the ball. This kid is the fastest, the strongest. Like, he is capable of anything, but he could not figure out whether he should throw it a third or first because there were runners going to both. And instead, he just stood there and, like, froze. But, like, the epitome of, like, freezing. Like, he can't, like, his mind freezes, body freezes. I had a teen once. She used to do this thing, and I'm going to put it in the freeze category. She would plant herself.
If someone does experience freeze, especially like in the midst of a trauma, there tends to be a ton of guilt related to it. Like, why didn't I do something to fight back? Why didn't I run? Why didn't I, you know, do these things? And you know, we just don't get to choose how we react. We don't.
Well, and some people may be more prone to respond in any of those four ways than others, but we all potentially could respond in any of those four ways at any time, because what is happening on an unconscious level is your brain is making these split second decisions. Your brain, its prime directive is to keep you safe.
Right.
In whatever way it feels like that's going to work. So if it feels like whatever is my threat right now, if fighting is going to get me safe and out of here, that's what I'm going to do. If freezing is going to make me safe and out of here, that's what I'm going to do. This isn't a conscious thing. So this isn't anything these kiddos are not aware that this is what's happening. It's in the lower part of the brain. It's a almost pre-conscious thing, split second. Fawn, just to kind of touch on that, this is one you see it more in like a chronic trauma. So fawn is where someone is fawning over an abuser, basically. Or
like feels a people pleaser, kind of?
Yes. So feels like if I say or do the right thing, I'm going to avoid this unsafe thing. So walking on eggshells with someone who has a very erratic temper and you don't know, you know, so a lot of times you may see that with kids who have grown up with parents who use substances, because one of the things that happens there is you don't know what parent you're going to get that day. So it's not uncommon for parents that use substances that when they're not using, they have a fantastic loving, nurturing relationship, safe relationship with their child. But when they're using, it becomes more erratic. So in those moments, a kid might try to be overly people pleasing. That also leads into, just like we were talking about with the freezing of not being able to make a decision about something, which one is going to make them mad or which one do they want me to do? Mm-hmm. Which one is going to make them be more, you know, happy with my decision?
They actually see that a lot in my children. You know, I'll ask a question and it's almost like I can see the wheels turning and I have to say, I want you to answer what you actually think and feel, not what you think I want to hear.
Yeah.
Like, I want you to express how you feel.
Yeah.
You know, like I will take it. I'm a big girl, but you're going to be mad. Maybe I can still say it.
And I think you see that a lot, especially in the honeymoon period, when the child is first placed with you and they're just trying to be on their best behavior, partially because they're freaked out of their mind about what they just went through.
And, you know, I think about even the evolution of how much we've learned about trauma in the last 25 years since I've been in the field. Trauma-informed care, that was not a thing when in the 90s when I was in college. When we talked about trauma, we really talked about it with combat veterans. Even then, like, there was an acknowledgement that kids in foster care probably experienced trauma and PTSD, but it was just starting to really emerge how the, so we didn't even talk about freeze. We talked about fight or flight.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the behaviors we might see when they're in the fight mode.
This is one of those, because it's such a good description of how we have to be curious and be investigators of what is the trigger for someone. So when I was working at a group home, obviously we had a lot of kids. There were 60 kids there
at
any given time. It's a lot of kids.
There were many adults.
It felt like one or two.
Yeah.
But the ratio is 1-6. Yeah. It's a really tough situation in group homes. I've worked at a few. This one kiddo, he was probably fifth or sixth grade. And he was regulated almost all the time. He was one of those just really remarkable kids, did well in school, did well with his peers, nothing ever rattled him. And then every several weeks, he would lose it and he would flip tables and he would throw stuff. And it was like, what the heck is going on here? This kid is like cool as a cucumber all the time. And then he starts to escalate. So when the staff who worked in this house, who I later married, he was like, you know, I have to figure this out. This is, so he started noticing patterns and it took him a few times to notice it. And he was like, it's only happening at dinner time, but it's not every dinner time. So when is this? And then finally he was able to nail it down and he was like, it's every time we have chicken wings. And so he figured that out after he calmed the kiddo down from that time. Cause again, his thinking brain's offline. He took the kid aside once everything was calm and said, hey, I noticed such and such, you know, this is happening every time we have chicken wings. And the kid broke down and he was like, yeah. And talked about a very traumatic experience at a former foster home that was related to chicken wings. And My husband was just like, cool, I'll let you know next time there, because at group homes, you don't have a lot of control over what's being served. They made dinner up front and took it to the house. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's okay. He goes, next time we have chicken wings, I will let you know in advance and we'll make you something else. And that's, he never flipped tables again.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That is such a cool story about trying to like investigate like the reason behind the behavior instead of just trying to teach a kid not to have that behavior.
He was traumatized.
Yeah.
He was in that moment. Mm-hmm. You can teach him whatever. He's like, I know not to flip tables. I never flip tables. And the other thing I think about is it would have been so easy for him to get mislabeled as being bipolar. Oh, every 5 weeks, he has these outbursts. Very true. Every 5 weeks, the menu changes.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I always think about too, because when we talk about investigation, so some of that is being able to take a step back and kind of look at things. And like I was saying earlier about how your brain takes a snapshot of the moment traumatic events are happening. And so any potential thing in that snapshot could become a trigger. When you see a kid that is starting to act out, then that is what you can do, even if it's more passive at the moment, is you kind of become an observer and make a mental note or track it in an app or a note or something where you are being aware of, so you were aware of dinner time. So then I'd start to be aware of, okay, what are the sights? What are the sounds? What is the lighting in the room? Where is her seat? Mm-hmm. What are we eating? What is the colors of things? Who's sitting next to her? All of those things, and seeing if there can be a pattern. Right. Hers was a little different because it was always at dinner. So there might be different ways of finding it. But a lot of times we'll hear there was nothing, just out of the blue. The kid started, you know, fighting. It's like there was something. They may not know, and you may not know. That's our goal, is to figure it out.
Anyways, like we were talking about the fighting mode, what are some of the other behaviors? Like obviously, like physically fighting is probably part of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Arguing, yelling, being resistant,
breaking things, hitting things. Bullying other kids, right?
Yes,
absolutely.
One of the things we talk about a lot in like the foster training classes are like talking back, and then like consider it junk behavior. Like don't even worry about it. It's just their way of trying to, I guess, fight for survival. Right.
Yeah. Well, and that's some, when I've done foster parent training or when I did staff training in group homes and stuff, that I would remind them. I'm like, you directed the kid to go like get his stuff for the shower, go to the shower. And they're like, yeah, but he just keeps saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm da, 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 da. And they're like talking back the whole way. I'm like, yes. And meanwhile, he's gone to the linen closet and got his towel and his washcloth. He's gone and got his pajamas, and he's just ignore it. He's
let it
shower, pick your battle.
Let him have the last word, as long as he's doing what you told him to do. Like,
I feel like fight is the easiest one to identify.
It's very, it's definitely very outward. Or I think sometimes, though, like the silent treatment in a way is very intentional. If it's an intentional silent
treatment. If it's intentional, yes.
Because I've had that thrown at me too. And I'm like, it's going to be a real, you know, real long
glaring
day.
Glaring at you. Yes.
The side eye keeps going.
Oh, eye rolling. That's for sure fight.
Oh, yeah.
Mini Jack has the best side eye. Like, even like from when she was like 2 years old, people would be like, dude, like, I feel like she, like, physically harm me with those eyeballs, like she like, that was like, that's genetic. Like, it's neat when you have kids and you can figure out like what's genetic, like what is it,
nature versus nurture.
And what's really cool is when you have siblings who you've adopted,
because
like you really see like, oh, that is your brother right there. That is absolutely nature and not nurture.
Oh, when we didn't talk about lying. Lying is that
like fight, or that could kind of be all of them.
Or maybe even flight in some ways, like you're avoiding. But it is, or fawn, you're trying to please. And it is prevalent in every single one of my trauma kits. is lying. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them.
About something to different levels.
Exactly. Exactly. It's usually petty small things is actually the instinct. You know, who ate the last cupcake? Oh, I think the dog got it.
They got icing all over their face.
Oh, yeah. That just, Betty just don't give them the opportunity. But
speaking of the dogs eating it, my mini Jack, this is the craziest idea ever. Like, she's in pre-K and they gave each pre-K kid a peep, like the marshmallow candy,
yeah,
in a plastic bag and said, you have to take care of this all week. Right?
What? Sure.
So day one, the dog ate it.
Obviously.
Right? And so she goes up to Jack Daddy and she's like, the dog. And he's like, well, obviously you weren't taking care of her if you let the dog eat her. And like one of my friends was like, it's a peep. Go buy her another one. I'm like, that's cheating. Like, like I've had a lot of kids who've had physical abuse. And my favorite thing is the first time they get to experience any type of, and I don't even want to say punishment because in
the first time they do something that will get them in trouble.
Yeah, yeah. The kid who spilled the milk the first night he was there and jumped back and covered his head and started shaking. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm like, this couldn't be more perfect. I'm like, dude, it's just spilled milk, whatever. Like, so I took my milk and poured some on the floor. And, you know, like, I love that first opportunity where I could kind of show them like, this is safe. Like, you could totally spill your milk. Like, maybe let's not do it all the time, but like
clean it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's not the end of the world.
Jack Jr. spilled an entire jar of like pancake syrup because he thought it'd be super fun to make pancakes for breakfast like 5 minutes before we're supposed to walk out the door. So there's an entire like thing of syrup on the floor because he broke the top and didn't tell anybody and then put it sideways in the fridge and then it dripped over all the, but like, you know, it's like a text. Hey, when you come home, can you clean this up? Cool. Okay. It doesn't have to be a big deal. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the behaviors that are more about like focused around self-protection. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how some of those fit into those, you know, fight and flight and freeze. These were behaviors that I was thinking about that really just like scream, like, I'm just trying to protect myself. And when you look at it that way, it's like this kid is trying to protect himself from things that have actually happened to him in the past. And it just makes it easier for you to be patient and kind and try and investigate it with them. And probably the most common thing we see, especially with the teens, is the food hoarding. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I have gone to change sheets or clean up a room and like piles of food fall out from the crevices of the bed or inside the pillowcases, inside the pillow, like four layers deep, you're pulling out like bags of random snacks and what have you. So food hoarding is definitely one of the behaviors that we see with kids in care.
It's one of the most basic things a human needs to survive.
Right.
And it's also something that they're, especially when they have then have open access to food. And hoarding happens even with kids that didn't have any
food,
issues
food
with
security.
Yeah, any food insecurities. Mm-hmm. Like it is very common in kids in care, just in general. Like a primal thing of survival. So I'm gonna need food. So I'm always gonna have access to that.
I can keep it in my bed where I can bring
keep
the bugs.
Right here.
Obviously, Jack Jr. lived in a situation where he was malnourished. That was like very obvious that we would always have food hoarding issues. I think we're at 12 years in since he's been out of that situation though. And I think we've definitely had a couple years clean of that now finally, but like, that's not something that goes away in a year. That was like 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the road.
And being like a picky eater is another huge something I get to have a good time with, because it's what else could they have control over,
right?
Like, and I mean, it makes sense,
and that is something a lot of people don't think about, especially if kids have been in multiple different homes. Mm-hmm. Everybody's food and the expectations around food is very different, and food itself can be very triggering. whether it's chicken wings that, you know, a reminder of that, something that might remind you of home, or you don't like it. But the expectation of this home is you got to eat. You know, we don't make special dinners here for people.
And also a lot of kids who've experienced trauma end up with sensory issues or texture issues. So that's like a whole nother level of things. These three girls that they've been reunified when they first moved in a million years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago, they wouldn't eat anything I cooked. Nothing. So I reached out to their mom and I'm like, please tell me, like, what are their favorite meals? What is something I could cook them? So she would tell me the favorite meals and I would cook them and they would not eat them. And I would be like, this is exactly your mom's recipe. This is like the brand she buys. Like, what am I doing wrong? And they're like, it doesn't taste like my mom's food. It tastes like crap. You know, like it did not matter what I cooked them. Yeah. They would not eat it. They did not like it. Now, fast forward, I'll say maybe by the second time they reunified, like 3 years in, they went home and they wouldn't eat any of their mom's food. And she was making all the things that she had made before. But then they were like, no, we want sushi or we want her that or the other thing, you know? So because they had lived with me so long and finally felt safe, like when they started feeling safe, they started liking my food. It was so funny because then by the time they went home, they were like, you know, more attached to my food and they had to reacclimate. And now they come over and they don't want my food anymore because they've been home for so long. But it, just in that sense of like being able to see that experience of them going back and forth and how like food really made a difference. And I, damn it, I made exactly what their mom said she made. And it didn't matter. It wasn't made by their mom. And it really had nothing to do with the food. It had to do with like their trauma and their level of safety. And so, yeah, picky eating is definitely one of those.
Food tastes good. And so it's soothing. And a lot of times when kids are hoarding food, it's sweets.
Yep.
And that's very soothing.
Another one is hypervigilance, that self-protective behavior where they have to like constantly be on the lookout for danger.
So you're constantly scanning your environments and looking for that. It's really difficult to sit still. And this is something that is often misdiagnosed as ADHD. Because if you are constantly scanning your environment for threats, you can't concentrate. You often can't sit still. And so it looks like classic ADHD. And so if you have a provider that hasn't done a full history of the child and takes that into consideration, it's really, really simple. Like, we have really crude tools to diagnose people with. It's behavioral checklists and symptom inventories and stuff. So they give like the ADHD scale for the parent and the teacher to fill out and check, check, check. Well, hypervigilance would check all those boxes too. So let's give it a stimulant and then wonder why the behavior got worse. Well, you just gave a stimulant to someone who's really anxious. But to complicate not just hypervigilance, but any of these things that we talk about with behaviors is kids that have had trauma are not immune from having other mental health disorders too, like ADHD, like ASD, like bipolar disorder, like depression, like OCD. So then you have to navigate how to help them regulate their behaviors when they have these multiple forces at play.
And I would actually go so far to say they're probably more inclined to have a lot of those because a lot of people start using drugs to self-medicate because back when we were kids, like you don't have ADHD, you are just the bad kid. You know, you don't have bipolar disorder. Like a lot of the parents that I speak with that have drug issues, you start to talk to them, oh, when I got off drugs, I got diagnosed with these things. And then they tell you about their childhood and you're like, oh, you totally had these things back then before you started using drugs. And the way they made you feel is why you started using drugs. So I would say they're probably more inclined to have those things because their parents probably have a high likelihood of having them because so many kids that come into care are from, you know, drug exposure.
Yeah. Yep.
I would say clinginess, but that might also just kind of be part of the fawning, right?
Yeah. And that's the thing. Some behaviors may be the exact behavior, but it may serve a different purpose for that child. Right. So clinginess could be fawning behavior. It could be part of separation anxiety, that are you still going to be here? It, you know, it could be all of those, you know, different things.
Yeah.
So it's when you put on your investigator
hat. Yeah, that's actually one of the behaviors that's harder for me. Like, I would rather a kid kick me and like break things than clinginess, because like I feel like I can't breathe when they're like on top of me all the time. I know that's terrible. Like,
no, and that's a part of it too, is like, as caregivers, as parents, as therapists, or whatever, we're human beings too, and yes, we have our own stuff.
Yes.
Whether it's trauma or not, just we have our own stuff and our own personalities that, you know, we're trying to stay regulated and monitor our stuff. And meanwhile, you're like, I just need to use the bathroom by myself.
Or first thing in the morning, oh my gosh, let me tell you about these One Piece fruits. Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I need to drink my coffee.
The things that I struggle with the most is when they're like faces in your face. Like, they have to get real close to your face. Like, those are the hardest for me, but just try and remember, like, there's a reason this is happening. Yeah. But it's so funny to me. Like, I would rather you hit me and kick me and break my things than like get too close to my face. Yeah, I know. Trust me, I'm in therapy. I'm good. One of the things that they talk about a lot in classes ended up looking pretty differently to me, but the behavior of like age regression.
When we think about how old someone is or what developmental level they're at, you know, you have a chronological age. Emotionally, because of the traumas, their emotional age is usually not consistent with their chronological age.
Right.
It can become difficult sometimes for caregivers to kind of reconcile, especially when you have a kid that's really, really smart, really, really like does really, really well in school. Mm-hmm. You know, I know Shannon knows this, when you have a kid who's like really smart and like appears to have zero common sense, that is often kind of a piece of that where certain parts of their development is on target.
Yes.
And certain parts of it is very, very stunted.
You know, maybe they have never had an adult like watch them brush their teeth. That's something we kept seeing. They would come out and brush their teeth in front of us, or be like, I'm going to brush my teeth, and I'm like, cool. Like, good luck. But you know, they wanted us to be part of that. It's almost like, you know, a toddler, like how a toddler would be like, oh my gosh, look at me,
look what I'm doing,
I'm brushing my teeth. Or my older one will be like, I brushed my hair today, and I'm just like, good job. I really actually do try to obviously praise, I tease, but you know, there are things that a 12-year-old who's in a stable home would put on their deodorant and brush their hair and do these things maybe without being prompted. They might need to be prompted, but they're not maybe seeking praise for it. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's very obvious that this is a praise they're seeking.
So sometimes then that what the caregiver can kind of do is to, you know, recognize what kind of level the different parts of the person are and parent to those levels. So when you have a kid who's maybe struggling with those really basic kind of routine nurturing things, going like, okay, well, with their schoolwork, they're in, you know, pre-algebra and doing really well, so my expectations with that are going to be consistent with that. But I'm going to parent their other stuff as if they were a much younger kiddo.
Sometimes the behaviors are happening, and this is actually my co-host's favorite thing. She's like, the kid's trying to have some control in a world that's out of control. So there's certain behaviors that I think we see sometimes because it's like the one thing they can control, which would be like peeing, pooping, you know, talking, things like that. So like the selective mutism that I see in my kid who freezes, I might not have control over where I live, what happens to me, but I can choose where I use my words. So he just doesn't talk sometimes. Peeing self, pooping self. Sometimes those are like physical issues. One of the most common things that people are surprised about when you become a foster parent is not just the peeing and the pooping themselves, but like the playing and the poop and that kind of stuff. And I'm not talking about little kids either. So, you know, obviously you guys can both attest that sometimes that can imply or be a symptom of having had a sexual abuse, but it isn't always necessarily that.
It's for sure something for people to keep in mind, especially with some of those challenging behaviors, to step back and ask yourself, are they trying to exert control in the situation where they feel like they don't have any
Is there other ways that you can give them some control that don't include peeing and like, can you think of any examples
for
of things
sure
that maybe we could offer as far as like, hey, if, you know, if your kid is exhibiting a number of behaviors that look like they're just trying to have some control, like here's something that maybe you can let them have control over.
You know, choices. Something. Yeah. You know, and definitely like, what do you want to wear today? Even if it doesn't match, like, and that actually causes me to feel insane. You can wear your hideous red Pokemon shirt with those Florida Gator shorts. It hurts my heart, but you but you can do
you
it.
You can do that. Yeah.
You can do it. And I don't say anything. Sometimes with the food battles.
Mm-hmm. Like maybe, you know, taking them to the store and saying, hey, like, why don't you pick out some options for lunch or breakfast or dinner? Mm-hmm. And I think also having them help cook dinner gives them some ownership into like what you're cooking together. And also, like, if you're going to cook with me, what do you want to cook tonight?
We want to try to encourage trying new foods. And so we would ask, what new food would you like to try next week?
I like that.
And so they picked out trying fish. They picked out trying mayonnaise. They picked out trying burgers. And funny enough, actually, like, reflecting on it, those are the ones that have gone better than the ones that we have imparted on, you know, like, been like, you have to eat this.
Another thing, too, is when you think about the bigger picture of how they don't feel in control. They don't feel in control because they don't have a choice about where they live and that they're not with their parents. And so obviously you can't control that they're not with their parents. There are areas, though, within your home that they can have some control over their space, whether that's being able to pick out bedding that is their choice, or a picture to put on the wall, any of those little things that is theirs that they have a choice on, that they go with you to Walmart or Target and pick out this thing where they feel like their voice matters. To go back to that freezing when they have difficulty with making a choice, limit the choices. If that is too much, if you go in and you go to the bedding section and there's all those bedding options, and then you can see the steam coming out of their ears because their brain has malfunctioned. They're just like, you know that they like this and their favorite color is this. So you go, here is the Star Wars bedding or here is the blue bedding. Like, which one of these? Or do you want half of this bedding and half of this bedding? Like, get creative. But letting them, there's no right or wrong answer. Just what do you like?
Right, exactly.
As we've been saying, the most important thing about encountering these behaviors is, like, don't take it personal as a caregiver. And don't allow it to dysregulate you. Because that's a very, I'm going to tell you, I did that last weekend and I had to go sit in a parking lot and give myself a timeout for 2 hours before I let myself go home because I allowed myself to dysregulate. And I should have known in the moment that this was only going to make things worse, which is absolutely what it did. Instead of being the calm to bring this child into my calm, I was the frustrated, like, whispering under my breath, you're gonna lose your tablet, blah blah blah. And it just amplified the behavior.
Everything.
He didn't care what I was saying. He could not register it was just me amplifying his behaviors by my dysregulation. So that's like probably the thing that I have learned the most, and obviously still need to keep learning because we all suck sometimes.
On the flip side of that, though, like, yes, obviously we don't want to make situations worse, but then we're also like modeling that we are in fact humans, and we can actually model apologizing and owning when we have messed up.
I was beating myself up over this in therapy today, and that was what my therapist was saying, but you went after and apologized to him.
You modeled coping skills, you modeled apologizing, taking ownership of things, that perfection isn't needed to be loved.
Yes.
And to love. And so those are like, those are big things. And so it seems like in the moment, I know that it was hard because you put so much expectation on yourself as a parent to always be, you know, you want to be a good mom.
Yeah.
To be like, I had to put myself in time. I had to go for 2 hours.
I definitely have been beating myself up over that. But just to say, like, none of us are perfect and we're all going to continue to struggle. Even when we know better, we don't always do better. It's important to remind ourselves when we're taking care of kids who have had trauma, to not take it personal and to do your best to regulate. You guys started a podcast last year, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that podcast?
Yeah. So it's called Mental Mages. So you can find us on Mental Mages. Is it .com?
I think it's just mentalmages.com.
And we also have a Facebook, so Mental Mages, and an Instagram, Mental Mages Podcast. And people can follow us, check out our website. We talk about different mental health topics and how it connects to popular culture. So we'll sometimes talk about a particular movie, show, and then connect it with mental health.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.